Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Do you suspect you may be experiencing depression? Do you or a loved one have an issue with drugs or alcohol abuse? Joining us on this Medical Monday to address these issues is Dr. Jennifer Michaels, Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health center, in practice for over 15 years. She doesn't look it. Dr. Michaels is board certified in adult psychiatry and addiction psychiatry. In addition to her work at the Breen Center, she's an attending psychiatrist at Berkshire Medical Center, a devoted community educator. She lectures on a wide range of mental health topics. Dr. Michaels is also assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. Dr. Jennifer Michaels, always wonderful to have you here. I don't know why you honor us this way, but keep on doing it. Welcome back to Medical Monday.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here, Alan.
Okay. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I'm warning you folks, get in on it now, because if you don't, you're going to be sitting there at the end of a long line later on, if at all. Dr. Jennifer, let me start with this. We're about to vote. We who live in Massachusetts on medical marijuana. Where are you on this? I know you've had issues with marijuana in the past, but this is a little bit of a different duck quack, right?
It is, and it's different because it's not legalizing it for recreational use.
Sure.
It's legalizing it for medical use, for treatment of pain, perhaps glaucoma, other medical problems. And I think there's a lot of support for it. So I've been thinking about it, talking to people, and I'm curious to see what your listeners think about it.
Well, I don't have any doubt about what they're going to think about it. I may be wrong. I've done this a couple of times. My bet is that we won't hear much about people who are opposed to relieving suffering via medical marijuana. People swear by it, as you probably know. But who knows? I don't want to prejudge what people are going to be saying. Do you happen to have a cell phone in your pocket that is creating hell here?
I'm going to look. I have it off, but I'm going to look right now.
Okay. All right. So while you're doing that, I will repeat the telephone number, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And we're here with Dr. Jennifer Michaels, again, Medical Director of the Breen Center of Berkshire County. Let me just say something about David Phelps, for those of you who may not know about him. He's runs the Berkshire Health System, and he's a wonderful man. He's my friend. He's Dr. Michaels' friend, and I believe helps pay the bills, doesn't he?
He does. He does a great job, and he balances paying the bills with providing amazing medical care to our community. So that's not an easy feat these days.
No, and he runs a highly successful system of hospitals, one of which is mine in Great Barrington, Fairview Hospital, where, they do amazing work. And I know that's true, uptown in Pittsfield also.
Yes, yes. And I've been at Berkshire Medical Center for almost 20 years, and I work there. I'm also a patient there when I need to be, and so is my family. So we're very pleased with the care provided.
The Cloak Makers Union is a wonderful union. It's a human union. Never mind. Let's go to Rob in New Hampshire. Rob, you're on. Okay, Rob, go.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. So far, so good. Don't
All
ruin
right.
it.
I'm actually calling. I just heard, the topic today, and I just, I've been struggling with addiction for years, and just recently I've relapsed. Opiates, painkillers, and I guess my question for your guest was just, I've been really looking for resources. I've been having a hard time trying to find any places that are accepting anybody for any type of recovery program. So I guess my question in, southern New Hampshire, northern Mass., if there was any resources that she knew that were accepting patients.
So, Rob, I just want to clarify what you said to the audience. So it sounds like you've struggled with opioid dependence or opiate addiction, right?
Yes.
How many years have you been using on and off?
For about 12 years, You know, I've been clean for about 5, and you know, just this past year, or so I've relapsed, and just been a struggle off and on. You know, I have a full time job, I got a family, and it's just, you know, it's like I don't know what to do with. You know, taking a break from my job, I feel like if I take a break from my job, I'm gonna lose my job at the same time. You know, it's just a constant vicious cycle.
Rob, what you're describing is what we see all too often. Addiction is a chronic disease, and it waxes and wanes, and unfortunately, we don't have a cure, but we have wonderful treatments. And for some people who have had difficulty staying sober, it's a matter of getting replacement therapy. And that may be methadone, that could be Suboxone. It's important to take that medication that's called replacement therapy and add another layer of treatment. That could be getting a sponsor at NA or a therapist.
I'm actually on Suboxone.
Okay.
But it's just been... You know, I mean, when you know when you're addicted and you, you know you want to use, you just don't take the spot. You know what I mean?
Right. And so yes, I hear what you're saying. And what I think you need is more support. Perhaps someone who monitors you taking your medication every day, a sponsor at NA who brings you to meetings, and to not try to do it alone. Addiction really requires a biological treatment, medication, psychological like therapy, and social treatment, having people who are sober around you. So get those three pieces in place and you're more likely to do well.
All right. Would you recommend doing any type of inpatient, you know,
What I suggest you do is see someone who specializes in substance abuse. That person can perform an assessment and help you figure out where you need to be. It's a treatment assessment of needs. And you may need to go inpatient, or you may do okay with a day program or an evening program. But a specialist can help assess the severity of your disease.
I have a question, if I'm allowed to ask one. Rob, I wanted to ask you a question. Where do you get this stuff?
I'm sorry?
Where do you get the stuff?
Well, I mean, you know, off the streets. That's one of the biggest things was, you know, when I got clean the first time, was disassociate myself with all my, you know, all these people that I, you know, that I used with. And I did a pretty good job of that the first time. But now it's just, you know, I got back in, hanging out with those people again, and it's,
yeah.
So, fairly easy. So, you know, going down, you know, whether it be Massachusetts or, you know, Connecticut or any cities, I mean, that's pretty much where people, you know,
well, well, Rob, you're lucky that you have a family. You're lucky that, you know, you have a mind that allows you to take this course in which you know something's wrong and you want to do something about it. We appreciate your call very much. Thanks, Rob. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to, I wanted to mention, because our wonderful producer Patrick Don just told me to, you can get us also at Twitter at WAMCVoxPop or Facebook.com/WAMCRadio. And if you do a sentence or two, we'll read them. Don't worry about it. Let's go to Bill. All right. All the phones are busy right now, by the way. Let's go to Bill in North Adams. Bill, you're on.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Listen to your show. Hi, how you doing? Love your show. Thanks. I wanted to ask the doctor.
Yep.
What her opinion? What is the problem with legalizing marijuana?
What is the problem?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's currently illegal, and
good.
And yes, and so we don't quite have all the information that we usually have when we. Allow medications to be provided to people in the community, and so we're in an unusual place in that it's illegal federally, and we're probably going to make it legal for medical purposes in our state, Massachusetts, and maybe in New York too. And it does have medicinal value, and it also has some problems. But because it's illegal, we haven't we haven't studied it enough, and we don't have all the facts that we would have if the FDA were able to look at it and we were able to conduct more studies to look at safety issues and efficacy issues.
But, Bill, was your question larger than just medical marijuana? Were you just asking a question in terms of legalizing marijuana in general?
Well, my question was, is marijuana addictive?
Is it addictive? For some people, it is. You know, if you think about alcohol, most people drink and don't get addicted, but some unfortunate people do. And we see the same thing with marijuana.
What types of symptoms would a person addicted to marijuana show?
That's a good question. When they don't have it in their system or they're withdrawing, they're irritable, depressed, they have trouble sleeping, poor concentration. And the other thing we see with addiction is that someone ends up using more and more than they plan to use. They forego their usual activities and instead are engaged in smoking marijuana. So there's a compulsive, addictive quality to the use rather than using it now and then or once in a while.
Would you say that problem was worse or less severe than with alcohol addiction?
Alcohol is a very toxic substance. And if we look at alcohol, we can check out every part of our body and know that alcohol can have a negative impact on every part of our body, from our brains to our toes. I mean, we can have a dementia. We can have a foot drop from alcohol. And yet it's legal. And we're talking about marijuana, which is most likely much less toxic to the body, but it's not yet legal in this country. And I think, you know, it will probably pass for medical marijuana. I don't know what will happen, obviously, as far as making it legal in general. There are some concerns. We want to make smart decisions.
I understand. Just one more question, Doctor.
Sure.
Supposing it was legalized, would you still have an objection? I mean, there must be some therapeutic benefits if folks are going to vote to make it legal. Are there any therapeutic benefits to marijuana, in your opinion?
Marijuana diminishes pain for some patients. Is that what you're asking about? What is the value? Sure.
Yeah, why legalize it for medical use?
Okay. It has been shown to help with pain and decrease pressure in the eye. So someone who has high pressure will benefit from marijuana use.
Glaucoma?
Yes, exactly. Or for some patients who have appetite issues, it increases appetite. So there are known benefits to medical marijuana.
Okay, hey, listen, Bill, we're going to have to let you go. We're up against a hard break, which we have now passed. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you much. Go yes on three.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551. Hey, Jennifer and Joan and Tim and Sarah, stay there. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care, and the Center for Robotic Surgery, sfhospital.org. Harlow Luggage, Northampton, Massachusetts, featuring Briggs & Riley and Eagle Creek Luggage, handbags by Bagalini, leather goods, silver jewelry, and gifts and accessories by Brighton. Online, shopharlows.com. American Meditation Institute, Averill Park, New York, offering meditation classes for beginners working to reduce stress and enhance their health. AmericanMeditation.org. And Asopus Chamber Orchestra, Stone Ridge, New York, presenting a season of concerts including Natalie Merchant, Nadeja Fufat, George Lopez, Kurt Starr, and Joanna Schroer. AsopusChamberOrchestra.com.
And we are back with the wonderful Jennifer Michaels. She's at the Breen Center and at the Berkshire Medical Center. There we are. Anyway, let's go to Jennifer in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on.
Hello. Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a family history of bipolar disorder. And while I've never experienced symptoms myself, I have dealt for many, many years with depression. I have avoided taking any SSRIs for it because there was a point at which the research said that SSRIs could possibly trigger a manic episode in people with a family history of depression. But despite years of therapy, I'm now feeling like I'm up against a wall and needing a leg up from medication. And I'm wondering if the doctor can tell me a bit about what the current research says about the risks of SSRIs for folks with family histories of bipolar disorder.
Jennifer, excellent question. And I'm glad you're bringing it up because I would think other people are wondering about this. We know that when a family has bipolar in it, that other members may have a latent form that can manifest with antidepressants. The other thing to realize is that you don't even have to have a family history. You could take an antidepressant and it will cause a hypomanic or low-level manic episode. That's a low likelihood, but it could happen. Given that you have persistent depression, and if you have not had manic episodes, you have depression, it would be good to try an antidepressant. It would be time to try it if you feel like the benefits outweigh the risks, and just be monitored very closely. One of the first signs of a manic episode is decreased need for sleep. So you would want to make sure you're sleeping well. Or feeling more irritable on the medication. So I think if you have persistent depression, it's not responding to your therapy, consider antidepressants.
Let me see if I get this straight, just to understand this. Manic depression means that you're either depressed or you're manic, right? Bipolar?
Yes.
Okay. So this drug will modify both feelings or not?
Well, it's a little complicated. We're talking about the illness of manic depression. That's one illness.
Yes.
And then we're talking about the illness of major depression, and they're separate illnesses.
Sure, got it.
But someone can present with major depression and then take an antidepressant, and their latent bipolar will manifest. They'll become manic on it.
Ah.
And so I think Jennifer is concerned that her depression will flip into mania.
Yeah, it's a question of the devil you know versus the devil you don't know.
Yes.
And interesting.
It's very interesting. And what I said is you don't even have to truly have this latent bipolar disorder to have an antidepressant precipitate a hypomanic episode. That in a subgroup of people, they will experience antidepressants as alleviating depression, then causing mania.
Now, a lot of people are on these antidepressants. Are they on these?
They're very common. Some of the most commonly prescribed medications. Yes.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And they treat depression. They can treat anxiety, various phobias. They're used for obsessive compulsive disorder. So they're really ubiquitous in psychiatry, not just for depression.
Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Right.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye. Joan in Northampton. Okay, Joan,
yes.
You're on.
Hi. My question is, I have always been really reticent to take drugs of any kind to mess around with whatever is going on. But a lot of my friends, especially in the 70s and 80s, people were pretty indiscriminate about what they would prescribe. I am going through a very hard time in many areas of my life, and people encourage me to take something to help me to sleep better or this or that. And I'm at a point where I wonder, at what point do you know that what you're experiencing is normal depression? I hate to say that, you know, normal depression, but I mean, you know, it's reasonable given your circumstance as opposed to something that really requires you to be medicated.
That's
Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes total sense. And sometimes it's difficult to tease out because some life events can be very depressing or disruptive. And oftentimes it's best to not ask a friend to help with the decision, but maybe ask a professional who can
but I'm just saying that over the years people have said to me, why? I mean, I've just had multitude of things of losses, and I've always felt that I handled them okay. And I mean, I have times when I don't sleep well and I'm very stressed, but I mean, when it's financial, it's emotional, it's job and it's family, I think that's kind of a normal response to those things.
I think you're right. I think sometimes it's useful to think about depression this way, that it's a gray cloud that follows you wherever you go. So even if you got the job of your dreams or you won the lottery, that cloud would still color your day. And that's what a major depression is like.
Okay.
Does that help at all?
It does. I mean, I have had family members who have had major depression. I don't feel like I've never felt myself to be in the same category. By the same token, I don't want to, you know, fool myself into thinking that maybe, you know, but I don't want to, like, invite trouble. I've never, like I said, I've never taken drugs. I've never felt I've always been, in fact, vehemently against them unless they're really, really needed. So that's why I'm kind of in this thing, well, if I can't sleep, I guess I'll just have to work on it.
Well, what are some, Jennifer, what are some of the classic signs? I mean, does one, in order to say, okay, this is now getting very, very serious, is the thoughts of suicide, for example. Is that one of them?
Yes. Yes, Alan. And that's a very severe symptom, obviously. Yeah. But some of them can be more subtle. Not sleeping so well, waking up many times during the night, or the opposite even, having difficulty getting out of bed, poor concentration, low motivation. Some people feel bad, you know, I'm a bad person, or I'm guilty, I did bad things, and they ruminate, obsess, decreased interest in usual activities. So there's a list, and you don't have to have them for a long time to meet the criteria. It's 2 weeks. If you've been suffering for 2 weeks with symptoms like the ones I mentioned, then you probably should see a psychiatrist who can help you sort out treatment. What do you think, Joan? Is that helpful?
It is. Like I said, for me, it feels like when you're waking up in the middle of the night and you have things that are hovering over your head, it just seems to me that that's a reasonable response. If I or anybody didn't have those kinds of reactions, especially in these times, like people who have lost their jobs, their homes, their this, their that, you know, I mean, when that kind of comes to a crux, I would think you would wake up in the middle of the night anyway.
Yes, but please be aware that stress in our lives can precipitate true major depression. We're wired in such a way that stress response over time will lead to major depression. And that's a valid illness brought on by the environment.
Joan, thank you so much.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Right, bye-bye.
A little business here. You can get us at Twitter at WAMC, at the at sign, at WAMC Vox Pop, or Facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Jennifer Michaels is with us. We always love it. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are very good. Let us go to Tim in Guilderland. Hi, Tim. How are things in Guilderland?
Guilderlandish, but they're pretty good. Dr. Michaels, isn't there? Do you deal at all with people that overeat, which is an addiction in itself, and it's very noticeable in America, probably North America. I'm not sure about Canada, but there's an enormous. Food is cheap. It's a way of satisfying a need or some kind of urge. And I think this may be out of your bailiwick, but...
I do treat people who have eating problems and compulsive eating or addictive eating. And you know, what's interesting, if you look at brain scans of compulsive eaters, the part of the brain that is damaged by cocaine addiction or alcohol addiction can also be damaged by food addiction.
Yeah, but I mean, it's behavioral, and it's like it's a way of people dealing with stress and
absolutely,
yes,
absolutely, yeah,
yes,
and it's and it's really noticeable, and I think part of the issue is that. Food is, we're very lucky in this country because food is actually relatively inexpensive.
I don't know why we're lucky. I mean, I don't know whether you have this, Tim.
I do not, but I see it. But I see it every day.
But I have it. I mean, and I'm skinny. But I can't resist just shoving stuff in my mouth. I mean, it's just part of the deal.
But I was going to say, like, not eating the entire bag of donuts or the entire...
Or any of them.
Well, also, I don't think we were made to eat donuts. And I think that's part of the problem that, you know, I call food my drug of choice because it's so rewarding and yummy and comforting. And the food we eat now is not the food we were biologically made to eat. And our brain responds like... an addict because it's so delicious and it's high sugar and all of those things.
I was going to say, aren't we addicted to sugar?
We are. We are.
But at the same time, it's like I can eat one donut, and it's really great. But then I push myself away, so I'm not going to eat. It's I don't think it's being. I'd love to hear Dr. Michaels talk about this. Is that it's like people need to put them. push themselves away from the table. You do not have to eat the whole portion of chicken at dinner.
Well, it's except that if you are a compulsive eater, it's comparable to that Nancy Reagan just say no to drugs, that if you are compelled to eat or it's so rewarding, it's so hard to say no, you will continue. And it's important to realize the part of your brain that says yes is much more primitive and reflexive than the part of the brain that says no, stop. And so at some point you are reflexively eating, gorging, using drugs because your primitive brain rules the part of your brain that knows better. And I think we can all relate to that on some level.
I can.
Yeah. That, you know, the whole pie, the dozen donuts, the pint of ice cream, or for an addict out there, relapsing on OxyContin, even though he doesn't want to or knows better.
But isn't it something like the old Oklahoma song, with me, it's all or nothing? I mean, in my case, I'm fine as long as it's nothing. But once I take that first bite of something illicit or illegal, forget it.
Yeah,
but isn't part of it is simply being an adult human being and saying, I don't want to eat this whole piece of chocolate cake.
I think that if you are genetically wired for addiction, you are going to struggle with this for most of your life on some level. And it sounds like you are fortunate and do not have that genetic wiring.
Yeah, but it sounds
wiring.
Like he's got somebody he's arguing with about this.
So I think I get all the donuts and you get none, Tim.
Well, the thing is, it's like it's part of being an adult human being, saying like, I don't want to eat this whole portion of this steak. I don't want to eat this whole two pieces of cake. And that's like part of being a responsible, grown-up human being and saying, no, I don't want dessert now. I'll do something else. And I don't know how you, as a doctor, how you can inculcate that in people and say, like, no, you really don't have to eat that whole...
I think if we took a poll out there, more people would be eating the third piece of cake and feeling guilt and not be in control. And I applaud you for your self-control, but I think it's more common that we struggle with these issues. Think of all the diet books out there because we struggle. And I think what we have to do is help people to strengthen the part of their brain that says no, and also find other rewards that are not compulsive or not food or drugs. And it can be challenging because food is you know, a second away, a dollar away.
Hey, Tim,
I know Alan has people waiting, but I know you do. Just one comment. There should be something called replacement therapy. Instead of eating that second piece of chocolate cake, find some reward.
As long as it's an honest secondary reward.
What I mean.
You wouldn't want to go from chocolate cake, for example, to sex, do you? I mean, that would be a problem also. Or maybe it wouldn't be.
But Alan has people waiting. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Tim.
Bye-bye. Right. Thank you.
Yeah, that's right. Let's go to Sarah in Saratoga Springs. Okay, Sarah, you're on.
I'm still laughing about the chocolate cake versus the sex thing. the newer drugs that are out there that deal with the part of our brain, the addictive part of our brain, what do you think of those?
Are you talking about medications that treat addiction or newer drugs like the synthetic drugs that are now causing new addictions?
No, I guess there's newer drugs out there that there's a part of our brain that deals with addiction. Like we have this part of our brain that is the addictive part. And aren't there newer drugs out there?
To treat addiction. Are you talking about Medicaid?
Yeah, okay. Yes, they treat addiction.
Yes. And, you know, it's very interesting because in other areas of medicine, we almost always give our patients medication to help them with their diseases. In the area of substance use disorders, we are very bad at treating people with medication. So there are medicines that will help an alcoholic not crave alcohol. There are medications that help opiate addicts not crave opiates, and yet a minority of people with addictions will ever take medication and get the help they need. So the medicines work. They've been examined, FDA approved, but either because of stigma or or something else, you know, not wanting to take a medication. I was addicted to a medicine, so I'm not taking a medicine now. Most patients reject medication for addictions.
Do these newer medications have side effects? Is that one of the reasons?
Yes, they can. They certainly can, just like any other medication. But they're not so severe that that would preclude someone from a trial of these medications. And they can help.
Are the drugs, newer drugs, specific to the addiction, or you just have to be addicted to something to take?
They are very specific. So there are medications that work for alcoholism. There are medications that work for opioid dependence. And then we have areas where we have no medicine. We have no medical treatment for cocaine dependence or marijuana dependence.
What about eating disorders?
There are medications. They tend to be antidepressants and medications like that that treat eating disorders.
Sarah, we got to take a break. We're going to let you go. Thank you very much, Sarah. Thanks for calling. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Again, you can get us at Twitter at WAMCVoxBox or Facebook.com/WAMCRadio. We're here with the wonderful Dr. Jennifer Michaels, and we will be right back. Allison, Stacy, Bill, stay right there.
Support for WAMC comes from the Hudson Valley Heart Center, providing cardiovascular care throughout the Hudson Valley with services including nuclear, echo, CT angio, and vascular testing to help evaluate cardiovascular wellness. HVHeartCenter.com. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, Poughkeepsie, hosting an open house Saturday, October 13th, 10 a.m. at the St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, 4th floor. Adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. Woodland Pond at New Paltz, Life Care Retirement Living in the Mid-Hudson Valley, 845-256-5520. And the Great Chocolate Train Festival, Hamilton, New York, live music, chocolate games, and rides for all ages, September 29th from 10 till 4, chocolatetrainfest.com.
And we're back. We're discussing movies. We saw The Master this weekend, and it was quite something. It has all kinds of psychological dimensions to it. Let's go to Allison in Dutchess County. Whoa. Allison in Dutchess County, you are on. Go.
Hi. How are you today?
Hey.
I was hoping that Dr. Michaels could comment on the management of patients when they're released from the hospital after being prescribed potentially addictive drugs in the hospital, particularly post-surgical situations where pain medications are needed. I just found that the follow-up, I'm currently recovering from a surgery, and I found that the follow-up was really inadequate from the doctors that prescribed it in the hospital, because often the prescribing doctors are pain management people who are different than your surgeon, who's the one that you're going to be naturally following up with. And it would seem to me that it is not surprising that a lot of people get in trouble with becoming addicted to these medications, given the lack of oversight, being sent home on, for me, it was two potentially drugs that could be addictive, with the instructions saying, use as needed for pain, gradually decrease dose.
So what were they, Percocet and morphine?
No, in my case, Nucynta and Valium. And the drug that I actually had trouble with was the Valium. It was given for muscle spasms. And, the label read, use as needed, decrease slowly. And so when I felt that the muscle spasm aspect of the pain was gone, I did exactly that and, stopped taking it over the course of maybe 5 days. And 3 days later, I was horrifically ill, and I had no idea what was happening. And, it turned out to be a withdrawal from the Valium. But I had terrible trouble even getting in contact with the doctor that had prescribed it to me, and even more trouble getting any concrete information from her on what I should do about it. And it just made me frustrated, and I felt that the doctors should have, if they send you home on such powerful drugs, somebody should be following up and calling in and checking and saying, well, what dose are you on and how are we going to manage this? And there was nobody doing that. And I just wanted to hear what Dr. Michaels thought of that, if that was how some of her patients, you know, ended up in trouble, or if this was something sort of isolated that I experienced.
Well, it's a great question you bring to mind. Mm-hmm. Allison, I'd like to say you're the only one I've heard this story from, but unfortunately many of my patients tell me this story.
Mm-hmm.
And what I hear is they were in an accident, they had surgery, they received a large prescription for medication, they called the office, got another prescription for another month or two, and then by the third month, they're addicted and they may be cut off or they need more, and then they start buying it on the street. So it's very common. I think part of the reason we're over-prescribing to people is that we don't want them to be in pain. There was, there was a move to manage pain better, and no one should be in pain. But we're overdoing it to the point that we're killing people. You know, people can overdose from these medications. And
yeah,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
In my case, I don't really think, you know, I'd only had a small amount of medication, and it was only like 3 weeks that I was on it. And I've been told that apparently I'm only in a small percentage of the population that would have a reaction like that to diazepam. But I don't think it was the over-prescribing, because I truly did have a painful surgery mm-hmm. that, you know, truly did require aggressive pain management for a long period of time. It was simply that I think that, that there should be greater oversight of this. The instructions were so minimal, and nobody was checking on, there was no protocol on how you decrease.
Allison, I think we got that part of it. Let's get the answer.
And so one thing to think about is having a visit with your doctor immediately after you have the surgery. If you have surgery on Friday, you should be there Monday or Tuesday, and maybe at the end of the week, so that you can adjust the medication based on your needs, because not everybody needs the same dose for the 3 weeks post-surgery.
Do you find that surgeons are usually able to do that? Because my surgeon wasn't able to do that.
So,
he felt unfamiliar with the medications, and so it was hard to find somebody to go to, in fact.
Yeah, and I think surgeons need to be more prepared for that, because, you know, there are now laws, there are guidelines, there's what's called a prescription monitoring program that will help doctors and other people, pharmacists, to monitor safe prescribing practices. So I think before surgery, it would behoove you to have a pain management plan with the surgeon. And if the surgeon can't help you, maybe you'd need a different surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And where does the
mm-hmm.
general practitioner come into all of this? Can't you go to your own doctor and say, look?
Well, that's what happened in my case, and thank goodness that there aren't that many people around who are truly willing to manage the whole person in that way. I find medicine is very fragmented these days.
Yes.
And I'm very fortunate that, that I do have someone like that, and I was able to, come home and have him manage it. It required him doing a great deal of research, because it wasn't things that he was, an expert in, but he is willing to do that, and he's, it's been dealt with and it's fine. But I was very frustrated that the prescribing doctor, who is not the surgeon, but a pain management person and a pain management team in the hospital, I felt that it was,
Allison,
they should have taken more responsibility.
We got it, and it's a very good point, and we appreciate your making it. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's go to Stacy in Pittsfield. Stacy, you're on.
Hi. I'm just calling. I was wondering if I could make a comment in the behavioral health category and then ask a question.
All right.
The behavioral health is that I think the stigma involved in taking medication for mental health issues is so strong in this country, and that if people can look at it more like you have diabetes or something else that is completely manageable with medication, it would help them realize that your life can be a lot better without it.
That's a good statement, and it's absolutely true, and it's been true for as long as I've been around.
Yeah, I myself struggled with that stigma forever and can't believe I spent 15 years the way I was. And my other comment would be about lamotrigine for people with bipolar 2, in that it was an anti-seizure medicine originally, but it's very effective at curbing, once you have your depression under control, keeping that at bay without triggering the manic episodes.
Yes.
I didn't know if you talked about that already.
Well, we're going to talk about it now. Go
ahead.
Yeah,
you know, it's great that we have many medications that treat bipolar now. It used to be that there was the old gold standard lithium. And for people who have been ambivalent or have felt stigma, you should know that there are so many different options to treat bipolar. And, you know, if you've been hesitant to see someone, now's the time to do it. Lamotrigine is great. Tegretol, Depakote. These are all newer medicines that have been efficacious in treating bipolar.
And the more
people, then I guess, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the more people who take them, the less the stigma, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. My question is that for me, it took meeting a psychiatrist who would actually provide therapy as well, as opposed to just taking that initial survey. But I find it, I have to drive 45 minutes to see him. I find it very difficult to find a psychiatrist who actually give therapy and maintain that relationship that helps diagnosis. And I'm wondering if that's a national trend, why it might be, and if that's going to reverse itself, and maybe like if there's an increase in that coming up.
So, Stacey, a quick response. Unfortunately, because of financial limitations, we now provide mostly split treatment. The psychiatrist provides the medication, and a therapist does the therapy, which is...
Right. That was my experience for a long time.
And I don't see it changing anytime soon, unfortunately.
That's bad, because I think that was the difference for me, with someone who was prescribing the drugs, was able to touch base with me regularly to figure it out.
Stacey,
anyway,
good point. Thank you so much for calling,
Stacey.
Thank you.
Stacey.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Let's go to Bill in Del Mar. Bill, go. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hi, how you doing?
So far, so good. Go ahead.
You guys can hear me okay? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm listening to your show. I had a question. My wife suffers from bipolar disorder, and it seems to run in her family. My first question is, what are the chances that my daughter might be affected by this situation? That's the first question. The second question is, are there any resources that your friend can point me to as far as looking for signs of it? Because my daughter's 13, and she's going into adolescence, and I was just wondering if there's any difference between signs of onset depression and your usual signs associated with adolescent behavior. And I'll let you guys go, okay?
No, stay there. Go ahead.
Yeah. Jennifer. So depression does run in families. There's a genetic component, also an environmental component. So yes, your daughter is at increased risk. Does that mean that she definitely will develop depression? No. I think that there are factors that can help her to be less likely to develop that. And having support, talking about depression, prevention, such as healthy eating, good supports, sleeping at the right time, not staying up very late, you know, having healthy discussions with family about wellness and how to avoid depression and anxiety, that all helps. And then talking about early symptoms like sleep problems, isolation, poor concentration. If you notice signs like that, you want to get your daughter help as soon as possible.
Isn't there also a problem with the self-fulfilling prophecy? In other words, if mother has depression, then the child sometimes thinks that, after all, the mother models for the child, number one, you know, and number two, the child thinks it's inevitable.
I think in very closed and mesh relationships that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when we give our children options, they realize, well, I could end up depressed and withdrawn, or I can become the president of the class, you know. But I see that kind of modeling more with very enmeshed relationships where the child doesn't have any space to explore.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, that was a great question. Thank you so much for asking it. Appreciate it.
Just one last thing.
Sure.
Are there any websites that you could refer me to as far as all the information you were just talking about?
Sure. There's NAMI, N-A-M-I, National Alliance of the Mentally Ill. There's also SAMHSA, S-A-M-H-S-A. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration.
Okay.
Thanks an awful lot.
Good luck.
All right,
yep. Thank you.
Right. Let's go to Ray in Portland, Maine. Ray, you're on. Hello, Ray. I think Ray should be on. Ray, are you still there? Probably listening on the radio and doesn't realize we're different on the phone than the radio. Okay, Ray, thank you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You've had it. Let's go to Robert in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Robert.
Yes. I have a question. I have some depression in the family. My brother has had a case of depression for many years. And one of the ways that I get around that, I've never taken any antidepressants at all. I push myself to be creative and to work on all sorts of creative projects. And so that's one thing that I wonder, you know, there's depression, there's eating disorders. After eating, sometimes I'll play piano, even whereas I might be having a dessert. So I'm wondering if doctors also try to point people in that direction, and also about whether, obviously, you've talked about food and exercise is good. But one of the things that really scares me a lot is that I think we're the most drugged generation that's ever existed. And a lot of these drugs are relatively new, and the side effects may not be entirely known. So I'm wondering about if the doctor could comment about that. And, and also when people can get off the antidepressants, when's a good time to get off them?
Okay. So as far as looking at non-medication interventions, we recommend...
Whoa, hey, Robert, if your radio is on, turn it off.
Thank you,
That's
Alan.
A rule. Yeah,
okay,
go ahead.
Okay, thanks. You know, we're looking at other therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness therapy, and we also are aware people feel better when they meditate or they do yoga. So we certainly add that to the full complement of treatment. As far as being on medication, that's something that is a discussion between the patient and the provider. Depending on the severity of the illness, the recurrence of the illness, the patient may decide to stay on the medication for life. And some other patients may need it for a shorter time, 6 months or a year. It depends on that discussion and the severity and the risks. So I hope that's helpful, Robert.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. You know, I once had a very good friend whose sister was psychotic and went through psychotic episodes. And we were having a dinner once, and there was a psychologist there who said, drugs are very bad. And this guy almost punched him. He said, you know, my sister was not able to live in society until these drugs came along and made all the difference in the world in her life. So.
Yeah, and I get to see that every day. Mm-hmm. I don't want people to be over-medicated, but to miss the opportunity to help someone is just unforgivable.
Okay, let's go to Alicia very quickly in Williamstown. We're in the bonus round here, Alicia, so faster the better. Go ahead.
Just quickly want to know if you see any difference or have any different suggestions for drugs for depression or for anxiety. It seems like the same thing is used for both. Different drugs for anxiety other than like a Valium or a, you know, an ongoing kind of thing?
Sure. There's Buspar, which is specifically for anxiety. There are also, be aware, specific talk therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness-based therapy. Those are two talk therapies that are focused on anxiety management. So you may want to augment whatever medicine you're taking with that kind of psychotherapy.
But Jennifer, I always had the idea that anxiety can also be a part of depression, can it not?
Yes, and people have agitated depressions or, you know, they're anxious during the depression. So that's why it seems that the same systems are involved and the same medication may help.
Yeah. Alicia, thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Irene in Oneonta. Irene in Oneonta, go.
Yes. I just wanted to address the comment that there's a stigma attached to taking medication. That the United States is 5% of the world's population, and it takes 67% of the world's antidepressants. And that also prescription drug abuse surpasses deaths. Let's see, it's car accidents and murders combined. There's more people dying from prescription drug abuse. It just seems like that, you know, we're a medicated society as it is.
Doctor?
I think that we do use a lot of antidepressants, and I think we treat depression well. We may be over-treating it. And there may be other societies where it's even more stigmatized, so people don't get the help they need.
Okay. Thanks, Irene. We're out of time, everybody. My apologies to all those others, and there are a lot on there on the line. John and Alina and Sue, they are all waiting, and not today. I warned you all in the beginning, but nobody listens, so that's it. I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center for being with us today. Support for the Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, health-quest.org for locations, and the City of Kingston, home to the O Positive Festival of Art, Music, and Wellness, 39 bands and 9 venues, including an acoustic evening with the Felice Brothers, October 5th to 7th, opositivefestival.org. Thanks to our engineer, the wonderful Zach Malloy. Thanks to Tiffany Brown Bennett for answering the phones. Our producer is Patrick Donges. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop on tomorrow's program, an open forum with yours truly. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.